Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. My name is Jason Lewis, and I am your host for the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I want to thank you for joining us today for the show that is shaping the way that the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. This episode is brought to you by OneCause, leader in online, mobile, and virtual fundraising software. OneCause supports over 6,000 nonprofits to reach more and raise more with innovative solutions. You can visit their virtual fundraising resource center at www.onecause.com. Andre, it is certainly a pleasure to have you back here today on the Fundraising Talent Podcast. You and I haven't seen in a couple. You're probably the last person I saw before I sort of had to get off the road for COVID-19. And I think I may have been the last person to visit you in Boston. And we're certainly going to look forward to getting together again. But it's a pleasure to have you here on the podcast today. Before we get started with our conversation, how about you introduce yourself to our listeners?
Well, hello, world. I'm Andre Gregani. I am the senior director of major gifts and facilitating impact for the Salvation Army of Massachusetts. I'm in my wonderful home office, right now, like the rest of the world, with my wife, with our three children, trying to get through the day. And yes, you're right. The last time we saw each other was Friday the 13th when the planet stopped.
Right. And it was, we were in Boston, and it was a dreary, it was a dreary day. And it was like the, you know, this cloud was coming down over, over everything.
It was a zombie apocalypse. It was actually the hottest thing I've ever experienced.
Yeah, it was not the best of days. And we hugged each other's necks and we hoped that neither one of us had COVID-19. And then we haven't seen each other since. But I'm glad to say that we're both in good health. And that's been about 8 weeks now. So, Andre, you and I agreed to talk about what today?
So I saw your post on Ian McQuillan's Who Made Us, the Philanthropy Police, and it really resonated with me, especially during this time in COVID, where, you know, people just feel like just because people happen to be quote unquote billionaires or millionaires that they need to, you know, it's their moral prerogative to give and to give it all or to give a certain amount. And that really struck a chord with me. And I think I made a comment and I got invited back.
So, Andre, unpack that some more. You've got to have more thoughts in that head of yours. So take us down that road some more.
Well, absolutely. So working and representing the Salvation Army and the work that's been going on just here in Massachusetts, we've already served 1.6 billion meals and since the beginning of COVID-19. And we've had our shelters open 24/7. We have areas which are, you know, COVID positive, and we have staff caring for them, and we have, you know, the homeless can't socially distance, and you really have to have policies where they can't leave and come back, and you need to feed them and keep them entertained. And you can imagine what that's been like for the past 8 weeks, plus just, you know, serving at our hubs. And then, you know, you have that element of poverty, which really resonates with me at the, you know, the very, you know, basic elements of need: food, shelter, water, emotional and spiritual care, someone to listen for. And then on the other end, you know, for the purposes I think of our call today, you know, I work with, as most major gift officers do, I work with a whole range of folks with capacities that range from an ability, from the ability to give $25,000 a year all the way to the ability to give, you know, seven figures. For this, I think I'm going to really focus on the ones that have had the capacity to, and a propensity to step up and make some significant gifts in this period of time. And they've also been adversely affected by the economy. And really, they're dealing with the same emotional needs. And, you know, there's folks that can't have some emergency surgeries that they've been waiting for. There's people that just need to be heard. And who am I to tell them? It's like, hey, these people are suffering. You need to, you know, take out the millions of dollars that you haven't lost and keep our shelters going. I'm not the police of their money. I'm not the police of how they make their decisions. My job is to connect with them and share with them what the need is and figure out, you know, what world they want to see and demonstrate the need and hope that there's a connection there.
You know, to speak of connection is to sort of speak of that importance that I think this is what you and I were talking about before we hit the record button, of sort of being that connection. Isn't a lot of what it means to be a fundraising professional to create those bridges between those that have and those that have not? You know, if we don't see our work that way, in my mind, if we don't see our work that way, that of being a bridge builder, making the connections between those that have and don't have, then I think the donor and maybe even similarly the beneficiary, the person who's receiving, becomes some sort of a means to another end. It's like the donor is just our way of sort of creating, accomplishing something that we aspire to accomplish. And you could almost say that the cause, so that poor orphan child that needs to be fed and housed and kept safe and those sorts of things could actually be the same means.
Yes. I mean, I think this is where, you know, you and I agree on the messy middle and the efficient lane. It's like, you could either just send out our pantry shelves are empty and try to create a response based on that, or you can be a little less efficient and invest my time in a relationship and really get to the heart of the matter of what's provoking them. We have secured, from one of a gentleman on my portfolio, we've secured $250,000 so far since this began, and his business is not doing well. And, you know, speaking to his heart, I had our CEO and chief operating officer on the phone to thank him for his recent six-figure gift. Obviously, it's on the phone. And this is a day where his wife was in the hospital earlier that day. And he's telling our CEO and our CEO a story I've heard a million times, but, you know, he thankfully shared it, where he grew up in Eastern Europe and he was eating out of trash cans. And so when he thinks of, and he sees the news and he thinks of people just going hungry, that's the emotion that it provokes. And I'm not there to make him feel more guilty or less guilty. My job is to connect those two worlds for him and bring him back. And, you know, thankfully he's well, you know, doing much better in life now, but absolutely I enjoy it. I have to paint a picture of what's happening in the field to the donor. You know what, and I want to take a step back and say what our healthcare professionals are doing is absolutely exceptional. That is a COVID response. I mean, I stop every day at 7 o'clock and I clap for them, but there's a clear, vivid understanding of healthcare. You know, you're literally saving a life at that stage. Whereas, you know, we're in the public health policy realm of, you know, meeting immediate needs and even long-term needs. So there's a more abstract way of painting that picture. It's not necessarily, you know, putting that person on an operating table and saving their life or a ventilator. This is, you know, giving them a piece of bread and a full box of meals for their entire household to eat for a week, and then listening to them and giving them a level of spiritual care and emotional listening that allows them to heal. And that's a lot harder to quantify over a lifetime than a life saved in a hospital room. And that's really where I'm, you know, that's where my job comes in, is to paint that picture over and over again. And in a way that makes sense to that particular donor from their viewpoint.
Is what we've conjured up here in philanthropy, because I'm writing about this in my new book, this war on philanthropy that a couple of authors starting in 2018 sort of started to sort of take on the way that philanthropy plays out in our economy. But, and then now with COVID-19, I see this playing out even more in my mind, much more divisive is some of the language I might use. I just had another guest on the podcast last week who was talking about some of the things playing out in the United Kingdom along the same lines. But my question to you, Andre, is that this polarization that is playing out has been playing out in our political sphere, the idea of sort of far right and far left, and nobody knows how to sort of exist in the middle. Are we essentially in the nonprofit sector creating that same polarization? And then is it only people who know how to sort of exist and appreciate the contributions of both those on the quote unquote right or left, or the wealthy and the not so wealthy, the haves and the have nots, that's actually going to know how to get this, sort of reconcile all this?
I mean, I think when you're wanting to approach the, you know, the wealth holders, you know, and you know, there's the Zuckerbergs, there's Bezos and the Arnolds, and, you know, even Oprah gave a pretty significant to my alma mater. But, you know, when you engage folks like that, that are publicly known or not publicly known, that just happen to have a capacity, if you're going to want to, I think the danger happens is there's going to be an element of response from that particular donor subset that might give you a $10,000 gift or a $25,000 gift. And all of a sudden everyone is going to feel, oh my gosh, they care about us. Whereas, you know, that's very much a responsive, like a reactive gift. Whereas if you actually engage them and learn what's provoking them, you know, you're leaving, you know, the type of gift that they're going to be able to transform the world is so much greater. And I think having that level of conversation and engagement can actually have that donor fund the types of conversations we're having that are going to help philanthropy overall in general really reshape how we're thinking about things. I mean, we have to be constantly innovating. And I think we got stuck so much in best practices and trying to keep on doing the same thing over and over again that we said there's one way of doing fundraising. There's one way of, you know, I'm getting tired of the phrase plain giving. I don't know if any donor who actually enjoys the word plain giving or, you know, language stewardship or, I think we joked and like, I don't think I've ever had a donor be thrilled about a thank you letter before or acknowledgement.
Right.
It's like, I don't know why we do these things and think that we're going to inspire someone. And we spent so much time in the office trying to craft a perfect response when all we got to do is pick up the darn phone and get through the, you know, and get to them and speak with them. I mean, it's just remarkable.
We almost seemingly create this deliberate distance between ourselves and our donors, for example. Mm-hmm. And it's the same, in my mind, it's the same distance between, think about Brian Stevenson's book, where he talks about proximity. Why is it that we in the nonprofit sector who are constantly serving people who have essentially been distanced from the rest of society in many cases cannot figure out that increasing proximity, not distancing ourselves from anyone, is going to actually work in our favor? That's what, you know, that's why I came up to Boston to have dinner with you. Yeah. You know, I don't know why charitable organizations and leaders and don't understand that just telling somebody to take somebody out to lunch or pick up the phone is actually a good idea.
Well, I think it's, you know, I can't guarantee that I'm going to go to lunch with someone and come back with the check that's going to solve the particular financial issue or sustainability of the day.
So is that what they're looking for? Is that, if they're not assured, is that essentially what's at the heart of it? Is that we're so in need of control and certainty and predictability that if we can't be guaranteed that I'm going to come back with a check, I'm not going to extend the hand and say, hey, let's get together?
Yes, because I think we've define certain roles. I think in a non-profit sector, we define certain roles in, you know, whether it's, you know, marketing, finance, development, operations, social, you know, whatever that particular role is. And yes, we put people in those expert roles, but that they're just thinking about that particular. And I think we're seeing this with COVID in every sector, to be honest with you. Like,
yeah,
but he's thinking so much about annual revenue and, you know, generations, no one's really thinking. I mean, the word sustainability is kind of whitewashed, but who's thinking about organizational sustainability at most nonprofits? Who's thinking about, you know what? I mean, look at Harvard, for example. I mean, their annual budget somewhere in the $6 billion range. They're constantly being spoken of about having a $41 billion endowment. Even if they were allowed to tap into that fully at 5%, you know, that's barely half of what their annual revenue is, because no one's thinking about, but at least someone was thinking at Harvard about sustainability to at least get half of their revenue in, not 100% of their revenue in. So, you know, we're in this constant cycle of trying to catch up, as opposed to, and the word nonprofit alone is what hurts us the most. We think like a nonprofit most of the time. We think we don't have to profit. And I think we should be looking at ourselves as not for profit. And, you know, we still need to have a bottom line. And what are the strategies, and how, and when you think about the bottom line in that way, instead of isolating in silos, your finance department, your development department, you're actually putting everybody at the same table to say, what are all the things that are keeping you awake at night? What are the things that are making us relevant? What are the things that, you know, what are our identity? What do we do well? And how can we work on what we work from what we do well, not on work from what is efficient? And I think efficiency and doing something well is a false equivalency. Have you read God and Money, True Riches by the Gregory Baumer and John Cortenas?
I haven't. Unpack it for me.
Two Harvard B school guys. One went on to go into ministry and one went on to the petroleum field. And they basically came together to talk about, you know, really it's got a spiritual take on, you know, philanthropy and giving back. But one of my donors actually gave it to me. And,
yeah,
you know, he's a Harvard B school guy. And it, I think part of our problem is, why, you know, here's a crazy thing. Why do I, as a fundraiser, demand more money in the nonprofit sector than our head of social services? I think, you know, in the nonprofit sector, I think we define, because we're not going, you know, like in the traditional business model, I would be a portfolio manager, a sales, you know, onto sales, and I would be based off of commission. And then we would have our heads of, you know, business development and, you know, and another, you know, they would be doing just as fine because everybody has an equitable share within the company. And I think we divide and we modify certain positions based on what that budget line offers, as opposed to looking at the overall mission and how are we all coming together to deliver it. And if we approached it that way, there would be more money coming in and more easily and equitable to spread out across the organization, and it would just grow more naturally.
So where are you seeing in your own work, Andre, the bright spots? Because we've talked about the changes that are necessary in these large organizations, these legacy organizations like the Salvation Army. Where are you seeing the bright spots where either your organization or others are sort of seeing this connection and they're learning how to be that bridge between those that have and those that don't, and starting to sort of make sense of it for themselves? One of the things I'm working on in this new book is this idea of sense making. You know, part of what we as human beings struggle with is just how to make sense of our world. And so we're always sort of grabbing at these ideas, these sort of polarizing ideas that sort of help us make sense of things. But I think what we actually learn from is things like experience. So where are you seeing those bright spot experiences where you're like, aha, that's what we need to be knowing and seeing?
In a lot of places. So I think we have some tremendous leaders with incredible hearts in the organization I work for, plus the other ones that I represent. And the more we're able to influence, you know, and, you know, use development as a laboratory to grow the organization and think differently, the more we're able to have them connect on a deeper level with our philanthropist, as opposed to just a thank you letter and a thank you call for a gift, and actually engage them on and have them, you know, it's this weird thing. It's like, I want to be the matchmaker, but then I want my boss to essentially do my job, because I think they're the ones who are delivering the work and seeing it, you know, more across the table. And I mean, across the division or across the organization. And I think the bright spots I'm seeing are that there's more vulnerability now of saying, listen, I'm not sure if this is going to be the right assumption to make, but they're learning that donors are going to forgive them for mistakes, but they're not going to forgive them for not asking the right questions and not making the right assumptions. And they're showing more wherewithal to be vulnerable, curious, you know, ask questions and show areas of professional growth and lean on those supporters of ours that have that capacity and the business acumen. And in return, the supporters are saying, listen, you understand, this is your world. You understand how to serve people. You understand how to bring them through and help alleviate poverty in their particular lives, how to break the cycle or how to educate and educate, you know, in that sector, how to work an international orphanage organization, you know. And there's by the bright spots I'm seeing is when our leadership and becomes more vulnerable to the donors actually end up trusting the leadership more because they realize, oh, I can trust you, you know your stuff. You just, you know, now I can help you and release this burden from you that's been hanging over you about this budget crunch. And at least I could talk through you with it and look at the numbers and help, you know, help figure out it and navigate a path out of here. And what I'm seeing is the bright spots I'm seeing is better collaboration than I've ever seen across the donor spectrum with leadership and, you know, all elements of an organization. And I think as a result, it's just going to make our mission and our mission being be delivered better and our vision executed sooner and more deliberately.
How many of us in the philanthropic sort of nonprofit space have ever considered the question of whether or not what we would consider antiquated or in some cases unjust policies and procedures to which that funders require of us in order to secure funding are actually a mechanism for the funder to avoid the vulnerabilities that they fear, which is to say, to maybe make the question a little more clear, you know, how many of us recognize that regardless of how much money, wealth, power, control you have, human beings will design structures, unjust or otherwise, to avoid things that they're uncomfortable with. And I think we've got lots of wealthy, high power control people in this country who feel very uncomfortable around somebody who lives on sort of the other end of the economic spectrum from mm-hmm. them. And so therefore they create this framework to which to avoid that uncomfortableness. And I think it's the sensitivity that we need to that possibility to not see them as evil or wrong or misdoing something, but in fact to see them as, because ultimately I think that vulnerability, you popped vulnerability into this. Ultimately, the type of proximity that we're talking about creating between the haves and the have-nots ultimately is going to mean, in my mind, that the donor, whoever's giving, the benefactor, is going to end up being closer to the beneficiary, and that's going to make them uncomfortable.
You hit the nail on the head. So I agree. So I think the further a fundraiser gets away from the field, the less they understand why a donor puts up those protections that you just described. I mean, the amount of meetings I've been in my career where it's like, oh man, they need to step up and give more. And why can't they do this? And you know, they're on our board. They should do this. They should do that. And it always frustrates me because I'm like, are you kidding me? They want you to engage them, but you hit the nail on the head on the other side. Pre-COVID, one of our centers in one of the hardest hit parts of the, you know, economic parts of the country in Massachusetts, you know, we have a wet shelter, which means people come intoxicated, high on all sorts of drugs, whatever, where we give them showers, we give them AIDS testing, we bring in a healthcare professional to evaluate them, we you know, haircuts, job training, new clothes, washer, dryer, hot lunch. And then they, you know, and that's throughout the middle of the day, so they can go to their sleeping shelters. And there's a lot of amazing, it's a scary place to be. And then on the other side, in a very secure part of the building, we have our childcare area and after school programs, where we literally have homeless families dropping off their kids. So they, or, you know, or really economically adverse and challenged folks who have food insecurity and other insecurities in their lives, where they can train their kids in that particular spectrum. Who doesn't love supporting kids? And then we have senior programs and all sorts of other things. Well, this legacy family, just absolutely incredible. You know, they created a family foundation. The patriarch passed away. That's who I had the closest relationship with. Never was able to get close with the children who were running the foundation, who support amazing amount of other causes. Just incredible investments and hearts for people. Well, you know, we did the final report after the passing, and, you know, and then they came and visited. And so the first thing that happened is, you know, as a fundraiser, you try to set everything up perfectly, and it's a very bad part of town. And they came in two very high, you know, high priced luxury vehicles, and, you know, we're just nervous parking it. Well, about 10 minutes before they arrived, there was only two parking spots by the building. Everything else you got to walk down the road for. And there was a car parked, and I was like, what's going on? And there was two people fighting, two ladies fighting, one with a beer bottle that was broken, the other with her head completely bloodied. And sure enough, the donors popped up, and I'm like freaking out, like, oh my gosh, this is gonna be the day. The donors showed up, and they're like, what is going on? They're terrified. And I'm trying to get our director, our CEO of that particular location, to focus on the donor. He just turns around and says to me, stop it. I'm taking care of the people right now. And it was a startling moment. And the donors got to see that it's like, he actually said the words, I'm taking care of someone who needs me right now. The wealthy folk next to us can take care of themselves for a few minutes. Right. And I was like, what? And then we went on this like hour long tour, and they couldn't get out of, along with me, we couldn't get out of that section of the wet shelters fast enough, but they couldn't help but look back. And out of that transpired a really healthy 7-figure gift. And you could just see their hearts provoked. I could see my own heart provoked. And they had no idea. They were actually ready to separate their relationship with us. And it wasn't until they saw the realness of what's going on, and the fact that we're needed, and the fact that they can be a conduit of that hope, that, you know, they were willing to have a discussion that's higher than 6 figures. And, you know, that's as descriptive as I can get of getting the donor as close to the vulnerability as I can get.
I can't think of the number of fundraisers who have referred to Henry Nouwen's, you know, little booklet, Spirituality of Fundraising, to me. And one of the things that I don't think we're thinking enough about when we begin to pit each other, pit ourselves against, you know, big donors, for example, is what Nouwen talks about in that book. And it's the idea that when we look at somebody with wealth, we oftentimes think that because they have all the wealth they need, that they don't have other needs.
Correct.
And he makes this observation that we oftentimes discriminate against the wealthy, which is a hard thing to think about when you read it. But how many fundraisers we reference that book all the time. But I don't think some of us understand what Nouwen is saying, that we discriminate against the rich in some ways, very much like we would accuse others of discriminating against the poor. And it's because we don't see their humanity as their humanity. We just see their wealth. And so therefore they just become, all we see is their wealth. And so when we think, when they stand in front of a mirror in the morning in their boxer shorts, that they're just a checkbook. If all that money wasn't there, and that's the same thing that the world has done to the most impoverished, most marginalized, most discriminated against people on our planet, is that we think that they're something less than human. And I don't think we need to do that to anyone.
Even moreover, not only do we stop at their, you know, and not go in deeper and into their actual humanity, but even when we look at their checkbooks, we're not even looking at the complex assets behind that. You know, it's like, just because someone has been rated as a billionaire doesn't necessarily mean they could give $1 billion. You know, they've probably set up, you know, if they're investment minded, they've probably set up their economic structure, personal structure, so they have just enough to live and maintain their lifestyle, and everything else is in some kind of illiquid complex asset that probably took a pretty significant hit from an economic hardship too. So, you know, yeah, we might be, you know, there, I think I've heard this multiple times from different people. It's like, oh, woe is them. They lost this, they lost that. It must be so nice to lose $300 million. Well, you know what? That's their personal reality. And that's going to affect their legacy. That's going to affect the plans they had. That's going to affect the, you know, the plans they had for their children. And plus they have mothers who are on Alzheimer's, who are in a nursing home that could be well cared for, but they're still highly at risk no matter how well good the nursing home is, and they can't reach them and can't see them, and they're passing away and they can't give them, you know, I mean, they're having real life emotions. I was talking to one lady who lives in a mansion and she's home and during this time, and she was freaking out because her 6 grandkids were running through the house after being in the water and getting everything all met. Like, that was her reality that day. And if I just said, hey, listen, there's people suffering on the streets, why do you care about your carpet getting wet? That wouldn't be very cool. That would make me the inhumane person, not them. And they just want to be heard. And that's that. And I couldn't concur more with that.
I don't want to suggest, and I don't think that's what you're suggesting, that we sort of give them a pass or woe is me because I have these, you know, complex, difficult assets. I don't think that's what you're suggesting, but this is what I feel like the message is coming across sometimes. And what they need the benefit of is not being overly sympathetic for that wealthy donor that they may or may not have, but they need to at least understand that any attempt at tapping into those resources is not going to happen overnight.
Totally. And the reason that they set up those structures is because they were mistreated and the relationship was mishandled probably several times over earlier in their lives when they were giving away a far smaller share of, you know, than what's in those particular foundations. And it obviously, you know, takes on a life of its own. And
I think part of what we're doing is we're in some way dehumanizing the large corporate donor because we see it as an institution, when in fact what we need to do is we need to recognize that nobody can write a check that's not a human being. Whether it's this large corporation tied to a major international bank or something, there's still a human being that at the end of the day, a human being had to originate that, and somebody's responsible for carrying out that process. And so I think that's what people of all walks of life have done, is we hide behind these non-living entities as if they actually make decisions, and they don't make decisions. And let's not pretend that the large bank, the large international bank, doesn't have as much of a humanity as the small $25 donor who's giving to the Salvation Army. So there's still human beings behind both of those contributions.
Correct. And the one that's representing the large foundation or large bank, we have to win them over on a human level because they have to go potentially to their siblings or their other shareholders and make the passionate plea of why they should release that amount of money to your particular institution that month, because we might have the benefit of, if we're smart and astute enough to actually treat them like a human being and with a, you know, with complex emotions, then we have to still win them over and give them enough information so they can go and in turn passionately make the case to the other people making the decision. That's the complexity of it, is, you know, they, you know, we try to send something, a form letter, and we think we're going to move hearts over with a bunch of statistics and a couple stories that probably 20 other charities or 200 other charities sent them. But to your point, if we get to the heart of the matter and the mind of the matter and, you know, across the table from somebody and treat that large institution like a human being, just like we would do over Zoom right now or and over coffee, hopefully next month. You know, they still have to go and make a case to usually four or five or more other folks that have each of their projects. And, you know, I think it's healthy if every one of them was connected at a human level. And I think the philanthropy would only, I don't think we were competing. I think the fear is we were competing against other organizations when we release this kind of, you know, conversation into the cosmos that, like, go build relationships. No, it's great. I think empowering people and making them feel great about their philanthropy is what we need to do. I think that's only going to make the world better and allow, you know, more people to enter this arena.
Yeah. Yeah, man, we could go, we could probably keep stirring ourselves up all day. But I've had you for about 40 minutes, Andre. If somebody's listening to our conversation, they know how to find me, but if they're interested in reaching out to you and continuing the conversation, maybe giving you some pushback on something you've said, or maybe affirming you with something you've said, what, how would you suggest that they do that?
Well, they can find me on LinkedIn, Andre, dot, well, my last name is funny, GORGENYI. They can shoot me an email, andre.gurgani@usc.salvationarmy, all one word, .org. Or they can go to salvationarmyma.org/restorehope, and they could find my landing page there as well.
All right, Andre, it's been a pleasure. You're always welcome always. Back. I look forward to be back in Boston very soon, and we'll keep pressing forward.
No plague next time.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all too familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.